The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
How are the chocolate-covered ants, Arnold?
Scrum says has a... I can hardly taste the ants.
And what are these, Perry?
That? Ooh, let me see. I think it's Japanese beetle, Cajun style.
Ooh, I love Japanese food.
How does it taste?
Crunchy.
We pulled it off. Admit it.
Okay, we pulled it off. Let's see if it lasts.
Are you kidding me? Insects are forever. They'll outlive us all.
What is that?
Tomorrow's prophets exercising. Whew, what's this?
Did someone order bees?
Nobody ordered bees. Open it up and see what's inside. What the hell is making it buzz like that?
It sounds like a bees. Bees.
I know it sounds like bees, but it's empty.
What? Bird!
Let's get the hell out of here!
I'm with you! Sacre Dieu! I am undone!
The victim would appear to have ingested toxic levels of bee venom during the last meal. They died of anaphylactic shock, a condition normally the result of allergic reaction to bee toxin or from massive bee stings.
Then why did the patrons also succumb?
Perhaps they didn't eat the same foods.
Were traces of bees found in the victim's stomachs?
I'm no entomologist, but the stomachs of the three victims were packed with insect materials, including antennae, carapaces, legs, and other such matter. Digestion had begun, and bees lack the horny outer bodies of other insects on the menu.
Bees usually die after they sting. Why were no bees found in the premises?
I can only conclude that the victims ingested every morsel of the bee delicacy that unfortunately fell them.
Destroyer 107. It's buzzing with excitement.
You are safe now, but your world faces terrible danger. Please heed that warning, too.
When archaeologist and TV personality Anya Creed encounters paranormal activity during a dig in New Mexico, she happens upon a metaphysical revelation that could change the world.
Is something happening at one of the casinos?
Oh no, they're pilgrims and paranormal investigators. They're here about the Santo Niño.
Santo Niño?
It means holy child.
Who or what is this holy child?
A young man appears by the side of the road with his thumb out. Although he's long-haired and bearded, and maybe a bit scruffy in appearance, a kindly motorist stops and picks him up. The young man is very polite and very friendly, and then his manner turns grave. He warns of some impending disaster, usually global in scale. The Santo Niño may have engendered the vanishing hitchhiker.
But there are those that see Anya as a threat and desire the secret that she alone possesses.
So you have done me the honor of taking my warning seriously, Eminence.
Just so. I myself spoke to God's Hound before he left on this mission of his. But I personally took Father Godard aside and charged him to recover this relic.
A very good day to you, Miss Anya Creed. And remember to look behind you.
Why would anybody want to kill me?
Mind if I join you?
Please do. I'm Anya.
Robert Godin. Father Robert Godin.
How is it that you happened by at such an opportune moment?
I was following you, of course.
Why?
Because I fear you have something that does not belong to you.
The sword?
They took him.
Who's they?
They are whoever comes in the night to capture beings like the Santo Niño.
Rogue Angel Number 4. The Chosen.
And now we seem to find ourselves at a New Mexican standoff.
So you need to ask yourself just one question, Padre. Do I feel lucky?
Available now from Graphic Audio.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Destiny of Eagles. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by David Coyne, Terence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael Raplogel, Jim Lawson, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Kate Torrey, and James Konacek.
It had been 3 years since Falcon McAllister had avenged the Blanchard family's deaths. But even with Asa Parker and the outlaws who had worked with him rotting in their graves, Falcon still did not know peace. For 3 years after his run-in with Asa Parker, Falcon lay low while he nursed his wounds, both physical — he still had twinges of pain from the bullet Billy Chalice had put through him — and emotional. His wife, Marie Gentlebreeze, had been dead for several years now, but sometimes he could hear her laughter in the still wind that was her namesake. And at night, wrapped up in his bedroll out on the plains, he could feel her warm body next to his. Falcon decided to hang up his guns and spend the rest of his days enjoying the fortune in gold that his father had left him. He headed for New York City. His brother and sister, twins Andrew and Rosanna McAllister, were performing in a Broadway play. He could remember before the war how they would entertain not just the family, but all the people of McAllister's Valley. Everyone said they were good enough to be professionals, but no one really believed the twins would actually follow through with their ambition. After all, McAllister Valley was a long way from the Great White Way. But follow up they did. Falcon went to New York to see him for the first time in many years. Falcon McAllister wasn't a man who was easily impressed, but it was hard not to be awed by New York. The streets were crowded with a steady moving stream of conveyances of all kinds, from wagons to carriages to trains moving back and forth through the city, sometimes on elevated rails, sometimes on the ground.
What do you think of our city, little brother?
I'll be honest with you, I don't like it.
You don't like it, brother? How can anyone not like New York? Why, this is the most exciting city in the whole world.
McAllister's Valley's too crowded for me. And New York, way worse than that.
Andrew, were you and I ever such country bumpkins?
Surely not. But country bumpkin or not bumpkin, I can't tell you how happy we are to see you.
Again, Andrew and Rosanna embraced Falcon. Falcon didn't say it out loud, but just as they wondered how he could be such a bumpkin, he wondered how they could be such dandies. If he hadn't known for a fact they were his blood kin, no one would have been able to convince him of it. That night, he looked at the theater marquee. The Power and the Pride, a drama in three acts, starring Andrew and Rosanna McAllister, in a rare joint appearance. There was quite a line waiting for tickets. Andrew had told Falcon that he didn't have to stand in line, that he could just come right inside the doors, show his letter of introduction, and he'd be taken right to his seat. As soon as Falcon entered the lobby, he was approached by a stern-faced man in uniform.
Get back outside and line you.
But I've got a letter to
I don't care what you have. You must return to the line.
Not wanting to cause any trouble, Falcon returned to the line, where he waited patiently. A carriage stopped, and three young women got out, then joined the line behind him. When Falcon reached the box office, he showed the letter to the ticket agent.
You are Mr. McAllister, the brother of the McAllisters?
Yep.
Oh, my goodness, sir. There was no need for you to stand in line. The private box is yours. Please, go on in.
Thank you.
Falcon headed for the lobby door for the second time that night.
Oh, sorry, ladies, but tonight's performance is sold out.
Oh, but I must see it. I love Andrew and Rosanna. Can't we be allowed to come in and stand in the back?
I'm sorry, that isn't possible.
Falcon stepped back to the ticket window.
Excuse me, did you say I have a private box all to myself?
Yes, sir.
How many seats are in that box?
There are six, I believe, Mr. McAllister.
McAllister? Is your name McAllister?
Yes. And if you're interested, I'd like to invite you and your two friends to join me in the box.
Oh, how wonderful of you to ask. Yes, of course, we would love to join you. That is, if you're serious.
Oh, I'm serious. What man wouldn't want three pretty girls to join him?
Thank you. But biologically speaking, we aren't girls. We are of the age to be considered women.
Of course you are.
I'm Anna Heckmeyer of Medora, Dakota Territory. These are my two friends, Miss Gail Thorndike of New York, and Miss Emmalou Patterson of Richmond, Virginia.
Well, pleased to meet you. Shall we go take our seats, ladies?
Shortly after Falcon and his young guests reached the box, the gas lights in the theater were dimmed, the lights on the stage came up, and the curtain opened. Rosanna was standing at center stage, reading what appeared to be a letter. She thrust the letter down by her side with her left hand, while with her right, she pinched the bridge of her nose.
Oh, what terrible news to bring me. I have word of the death of my betrothed. I feel as if my heart has been ripped from my body.
Just then, Andrew arrived in the costume of an army officer.
Claire, my sister, I have come to you with terrible news. My friend, your beloved Filbert, was slain upon the field of battle.
Falcon watched the entire play, more engrossed by the reaction of his guest and of the audience than he was by the play itself. Now, he was no drama critic, but it seemed to him like all the lines were delivered too loudly and with something of a forced emotion. The last lines were the most over-emoted of all.
I shall find comfort in the knowledge that honor brings both the power
and the pride.
As they finished their lines, both faced the audience, and Rosanna curtsied as Andrew gave a sweeping bow. The curtain fell.
Oh, that was the most wonderful thing I ever saw. Thank you, sir, for your generous hospitality.
Well, you're welcome.
Falcon enjoyed being able to share his box with the young women, and afterward, he enjoyed introducing them to his famous brother and sister. Afterwards, the three siblings adjourned to Delmonico's restaurant, which Andrew assured Falcon was unsurpassed in cuisine. It was a fine restaurant, and Falcon ate well. But it didn't take long for him to realize that New York City just did not agree with him.
Falcon, it's been too long.
Yes, please do stay a bit longer. You've only just arrived.
Well, I know, but I reckon I need to keep on moving. Seeing you two just makes me realize how much I'm missing the other kin. It's time to head on home. I'll be back soon, I promise.
Even as he was given the promise, he doubted that he would keep it. And he knew that his brother and sister didn't expect him to either. Returning to Colorado, Falcon tried to settle down. But the restless discontent that had driven him for many years did not go away. Then one day, out of the blue, Falcon got a letter from a man he hadn't seen or heard from in a long time.
Dear Falcon McAllister, my name is Billy Puckett. I don't know if you remember me. Back in 52, I was attacked by some Indians who didn't take too kindly to my trapping in their hunting ground. They killed my horse and left me with a couple of arrows sticking out of my gut. Your pa found me up in the mountains, more dead than alive. He brought me back down to McAllister Valley, where your ma nursed me back to health. You were the youngest of all the McAllister children, as I recall. Probably no older than 12 or 13 at the time. Even then, I knew that someday you would make a name for yourself. I've heard a lot about your exploits over the years. such as how you tamed Asa Parker, Billy Chalice, and that lot of outlaws. But the only thing I've been hearing recently are a lot of rumors, some of which are just too wild to believe. Those rumors have caused me to start worrying some about you, though. One reason I worry is because I'm a sheriff now, and from time to time over the years, I remember seeing Dodgers come across my desk with your name on them. In every case, the wanted posters were pulled back. But there is always a possibility that someone might not get the word. And when there is a reward of $5,000, dead or alive, it wouldn't take much for someone to ambush you. I know your pa used to get his mail at General Delivery in McAllister, so I'm hoping that you do as well. If you are still alive, and if you do get this letter, I would like to invite you to come up to Belfield, Dakota Territory for a visit. I'm going on to 70 years old now, and I think it's about time I got something off my chest. Billy Puckett.
Falcon did remember Billy Puckett. Remembered him as a sort of short, stocky man who laughed a lot. He remembered him as being a physically strong man, too, though he didn't know if he was really that strong, or it just seemed so from the perspective of a 12-year-old. Falcon hoped that he had made a good life for himself, and he wondered if Puckett had ever heard about what happened to Falcon's father, how he'd been murdered by an assailant who mistook Jamie McAllister for his son, Falcon.
What's he mean he has something he needs to get off his chest? Whatever it is it something I even want to know about? Damn, I guess I do want to know, if only to satisfy my curiosity.
Falcon had become somewhat of a recluse over the last 3 years, protected by a small circle of friends from inquiring reporters who wanted to write his story for the big newspapers back east. It was only natural then that rumors would start. One story had it that he had been killed in Abilene, shot in the back as he played a hand of poker. Another insisted he had been hanged out in Tucson. The wildest and most improbable rumor suggested that he'd joined the crew of a windjammer and was sailing the seven seas. One thing those rumors did, though, was to help him maintain his privacy.
Oh, hell. 3 years is long enough to wallow in self-pity. It's time to step back into the world. No better way to do it than to answer an invitation from an old friend.
On June 5th, 1884, the Chicago Convention Hall was crowded with people. It was filled with cigars, cigarette, and pipe smoke, and festooned with American flags and red, white, and blue bunting. In addition to the hall decorations, each delegation was identified by a placard that identified its particular state, while larger posters, photographs, and banners were thrust up on poles over the various delegations. Most prominent were the names of those men who had put themselves forward as candidates for the nomination of their party for President of the United States. Re-elect President Chester Arthur, John A. Logan of Illinois, a man we can trust, James G. Blaine, Barack of Maine, Senator John Evans for honesty in government. In addition to the primary delegates who were seated in chairs on the floor, alternate delegates crowded the balcony that encircled the auditorium. And others were roaming the floor, too, most of them working the delegates for their particular candidates. Amos Crockett from Maine was one such delegate, campaigning for fellow Mainer James G. Blaine. He and Joe Murray, who wasn't a delegate but was present at the convention and also campaigning for Blaine, had called Theodore Roosevelt to one side. Roosevelt was a delegate from New York.
Teddy, I'm going to ask you again to switch your support from Senator Edmonds to James G. Blaine.
I can't do that, Joe. I believe Mr. Blaine to be a corrupt man.
I'll have you know, sir, that Mr. Blaine is from Maine. You call him corrupt?
I call him corrupt because he is corrupt. Everyone knows how he manipulated those railroad stocks to enrich himself at the expense of the smaller stockholders. I know that, you know that, everyone on this floor knows that. And yet the sad truth is many, if not most, of the delegates to this convention will vote for him for reasons that have nothing to do with what is best for the country.
You are stating opinion, Mr. Roosevelt, not fact.
I'm sorry. I'm supporting Senator John Edmonds.
I'm curious. Why Edmonds over President Arthur?
President Arthur did a good thing when he did away with the spoils system by establishing a civil service. But that's as far as he went. There is more to be done. And John Edmonds is a reformer who will do it.
John Edmonds is a radical who will lose the support of half the people in the nation who call themselves Republicans.
Do you really think Blaine can win the election?
He'll win the nomination tomorrow.
I didn't ask that, Joe. I asked if you thought he would be elected president of the United States.
Of course he would.
I'm asking you, Joe.
Murray got a pained expression on his face, then turned to Crockett.
Mr. Crockett, would you excuse us for a moment while I talk to my friend?
I hope you talk some sense into him. Blaine, boys! Don't forget to vote for James G. Blaine!
Three delegates walked by, obviously drunk.
It pains me to think that the future of our nation might be in the hands of people like that trio.
You aren't going to switch your vote, are you?
No.
Then let me ask you this. If Blaine wins the nomination tomorrow, will you support him in the general election?
As God is my witness, the Democrat Grover Cleveland is a better man.
Surely you won't balk the party and vote for a Democrat.
No, I won't do that. I will support Blaine in the general election.
Then I can tell Crockett and the others that you will support Blaine once he gets the nomination.
Yes.
I hope that will be enough.
Enough?
To save your political career. Teddy, you are a practical politician, for heaven's sake. Since you know Blaine is going to get the nomination, and since you have already said that you will support him in the general election, won't you please reconsider and switch your vote tomorrow?
No, I can't do that.
You realize, don't you, that if you don't switch your vote tomorrow, you will have absolutely no place in Blaine's campaign this year.
I know, but that doesn't matter. I have other plans.
Other plans?
I'm going west.
What do you mean, going west?
I'm going to the Badlands.
You are going to Badlands? Why on earth would anyone go to land that is bad?
The Badlands. Not land that is bad. I'm going to my ranch in the Dakota Territory.
Wait a minute. That's a long way from New York, isn't it?
Yes, a very long way.
What are you going to do out there?
I'm going to ranch, of course.
Teddy, don't do this. If you do, you're saying goodbye to all hopes of any future in politics.
Can't you tell, Joe, that I am just paying lip service to these entire proceedings? Oh, I'm making my own little statement as to integrity by honoring the pledge that I made to Edmonds. I told him I'd stay with him until the last ballot, and I will. But I am here in shadow only. My heart and soul are still back in New York with the lingering ghosts of my wife and my mother.
How will your going to the Badlands help that?
I hope to become so immersed in my new life out there that the memories of my dear Alice will stop being painful and become beautiful. And I believe that hard work and fresh air are just the ticket I need to accomplish that.
You're serious about this, aren't you? You're really going west?
By God, yes, I'm serious.
All right. When are you going?
Right away. As soon as this convention is over.
Murray extended his hand.
I wish you the best of luck on your journey. And if you need anything, if there's anything I can do for you, write to me. In fact, write to me anyway, just so we can keep in touch.
Roosevelt shook Murray's hand warmly.
I will, Murray.
Three men were mounted. A fourth was dismounted, holding the reins of his horse as he relieved himself against the piling of a trestle. It was dark, but the moon was full and bright, and the twin ribbons of iron gleamed softly as they stretched east and west along this part of the Dakota Territory.
Damn, Thad! How long you planning on paying? Seems to me like you've been pissing now for the better part of a half an hour.
I ain't done no such a thing.
Finished, he buttoned his pants and remounted his horse.
Hey, Rufus, you ever seen them hydraulic mining operations? You know the way they use the steam power to build up water pressure, then squirt these big pipes of water against the mountain?
Yeah, I've seen them. What about them?
You think we could get any money by renting old Thad here out for such an operation?
Well, boys, I'm glad my pecker's providing y'all with this entertainment, but damned if it don't make me worry a mite about what kind of fellas I've hooked up with.
Ah, damn, that's the train.
We best get ready.
Buddy, you got everything you need?
I got torpedoes on the track, and I got this here red lantern.
How do you know that'll stop them?
I was a goddamn fireman for a while, that's how. Believe me, this'll stop them. When the wheels hit them torpedoes and the engineer sees the red lantern, he'll figure the bridge across Hart River is out. torpedoes, and a red lantern will stop any engineer who doesn't want to run his train into the river.
Off in the distance, they could see the faint glow of the gas headlamp.
Wonder how much money she's carrying.
My brother said it would be carrying a couple $1,000s, maybe more. They'll meet us in Sheffield
to get their cut.
You got a problem with that?
I ain't got no problem. Only thing is, we're taking all the risk, and they're getting the same cut as we are.
They're the ones that found out about the money shipment, and they're the ones who planned it. You don't like the way it's set up? Why, you can just ride off now.
I ain't pulling out now. I was just saying, that's all.
Yeah, well, don't say. Just do your damn job.
If anyone had been out on the plains alongside the track witnessing the passing of the Midnight Special, they would have been treated to a sight to stir the soul. Thousands of tiny glowing red sparks lifted from the stack and drifted up to join the stars. Smoke, blacker than the night, streamed back along the top of the train. A great gleaming gas lantern threw a beam ahead of the train, while a flickering orange glow bathed the interior of the engine cab. Clyde Baker was the fireman, and having just thrown in several loads of coal, closed the door to the firebox and sat down to catch some of the breeze generated by the forward progress of the train.
What's the pressure like, Cephas?
160 PSI. You got a good fire going, Clyde. We're running high, wide, and handsome.
Ain't nobody can make music with a whistle like you can.
Yeah, well, I always did want to play me one of them calliopes.
Behind the engine and tender came the dark baggage car, then the stock car, wherein in comfortable stalls were six horses, along with the passengers who had paid the extra fare to bring their mounts with them. Behind that was the express car. There were only two windows in it, but they were shining brightly, because inside the moving post office, Fenton Bowles, the mail clerk, was busy sorting mail and putting it into the pouch for delivery at the next town. In a safe in a corner of the mail car, it was an oversized white bag. Bowles had signed for the white bag when he came aboard, so he knew that it contained exactly $1,817. That was a lot of money, almost 2 years of his salary, and he was responsible for it. Being responsible for so much money made him nervous. He would be glad when they reached Bellfield so he could be rid of it. Finally, there were four passenger cars. Although this was a night train, there were no parlor cars on this run because it was a local, stopping at just about every town along the route. Vance Dexter, the conductor, was in the last seat of the last car. He took out his pocket watch and examined it in the light of the lantern that was just over his seat. Just after midnight, they weren't due in Bellfield for nearly 2 hours.
Cephas, torpedoes!
I heard them! There's a red lantern waving ahead, too!
Damn, the trestle must be out.
Buddy, if I was you, I wouldn't be standing in the middle of the tracks like that.
I want to be sure he sees me.
Well, hell, you know he did. Everybody get your mask on.
The four men had kerchiefs tied around their necks, and they lifted them now so that their noses and mouths were covered. Then they watched as the train, though slowing noticeably now, continued its forward momentum. Finally, it came to a complete stop about 30 feet down the track from where Buddy stood with his lantern. Buddy walked directly down the track toward the train, while Thad and the other two moved up the other side of the track, staying out of the light of the headlamp. The engineer stepped out onto the platform at the rear of the engine cab as Buddy came walking alongside.
What is it? Is there a bridge out?
Buddy raised his pistol and pointed it at the engineer.
Nah, there ain't no bridge out. This here's a holdup. You and a fireman step on down from that engine cab.
The hell we will.
Cephas stepped back into the cab. Even as he did so, Thad and Rufus were climbing up onto the engine from the other side of the track. Thad shot the engineer, hitting him in the back. He turned his pistol on Clyde.
Let all the steam out.
I'm just a fireman. That's not my job.
The bullet shredded Clyde's earlobe.
Now let all the steam out like I told you, or I'll shoot your other ear. And I'll take it clean off.
Shaking in fear, Clyde pulled the relief valve cord. The steam pressure dropped way below 100 PSI.
Now you sit there and be a good boy while we take care of our business.
Can I see about the engineer?
Sure. Look him over if you want. He's not going anywhere. And without the steam, neither is this train.
By now, the conductor was out of the train, walking up alongside the track to see what was going on.
What's going on here? What'd you stop us for? And why is this steam being vented?
Buddy turned toward the conductor. It wasn't until then that Vance Dexter noticed that Buddy was wearing a kerchief over his nose and mouth and was holding a gun. Buddy raised it, pointed it toward the conductor. The older man threw his hands up and backed up a few steps.
Wait! Wait, don't shoot me! Please don't shoot me!
Thad stepped to the side of the engine then and stood there, bracing himself with his right hand on the back of the engine cab, his left hand raised up to the cab roof.
Well now, Mr. Conductor, I'm just glad you're here. Open the door to the express car.
I can't do that.
You want to die for someone else's money, mister?
No. I mean, I can't open it from out here. The mail clerk has to open it from inside.
Thad jumped down onto the ground.
Tell him to do it.
Nodding in assent, the conductor walked back to the express car, followed by both Thad and Buddy.
Mr. Bowles, open the door, please.
I can't do that, Mr. Dexter.
Ask again, real nice-like.
Please, Mr. Bowles, open the door.
I can't.
If you can't get him to open that door, I'm going to kill you. Then we'll dynamite the goddamn door.
Bowles, for God's sake, man, open the door or they'll kill me.
Bowles stood in the doorway, a small man, balding, with small wire-rimmed glasses.
When I show up in Belfield without the money, Mr. Dexter, you're going to be the one who takes the responsibility for it. They're not going to take that money out of my pay.
No, for heaven's sake, Bowles, they aren't going to do that.
Get up there and get the money, buddy. Rufus, you and Curly go through the passenger cars. See what we can get in there.
All right. Curly, you go back to the last car and start coming this way. I'll get on this car and start back towards you.
Falcon McAllister had been asleep in the second passenger car when the train was stopped. Opening his eyes, he looked out the window expecting to see a depot, or at least a water tower. Seeing neither, he got curious, so he walked up to the front vestibule. He leaned out just far enough to see what was going on. That was when he saw the four armed and masked men. Drawing his pistol, Falcon stepped out of the car and on the opposite side of the train from the four men, then ran up the right side of the train until he reached the engine. Looking up into the engine, he saw one man lying on the floor and the other squatting down beside him. From the coveralls they were wearing, he knew that one was the engineer and the other the fireman, but he didn't know who was who. Falcon examined the inside of the cab as best he could from his vantage point to make certain none of the train robbers were there. Deciding that it was empty except for the train crew, he climbed up.
What the hell?
Falcon put his fingers across his lips.
Who are you?
Just a passenger. How's your friend?
Dead.
How many of them are there?
Four, I think.
You know where they all are?
No. I didn't see where any of them went.
Falcon leaned out from the engine cab to have a look. Just as he did so, one of the train robbers happened to look in his direction. Thad saw Falcon look out from the engine cab and reasoned correctly that he was someone from the train. Whoever he was, he had no business being there. Falcon ducked back inside. When he did, Thad ran away from the relative light alongside the track and out into the shadows.
Conductor, in here.
Mr. McAllister, are you one of them?
Why in the hell would they shoot at me if I'm one of them?
Seeing the logic of Falcon's question, the conductor hurried to the engine. Falcon fired back at the muzzle flash, providing cover for the conductor as he closed the distance between himself and Falcon. Falcon reached down and grabbed him by the wrist and half-assisted, half-lifted the conductor into the engine cab.
Clyde, get this train going!
I'll have to build up the steam again.
Don't tell me what you have to do, just do it!
Yes, sir.
Leaning out the side of the engine cab, Falcon saw Buddy standing in the doorway of the express car holding a white bag.
Buddy, I got your horse. Throw me the bag and let's get out of here.
Buddy threw the bag and Falcon fired, hitting it twice. The impact of the bullet stopped the bag in mid-flight, and it fell just at the outside edge of the ambient light. Buddy shot at Falcon, and Falcon returned fire. Falcon jumped down from the engine cab. He started up the side of the tender. Someone from the first car leaned out and shot at him. The outlaw disappeared back inside. Falcon carefully moved ahead to recover the bag, keeping his senses alert to the fact that someone was out there in the darkness.
You ain't get my money, mister.
It ain't your money.
Well, now, it looks like what we've got ourselves here is a Mexican standoff. The money's just lying out there in the dark, and can't neither of us get to it. Sounds like my men are killing your passengers. That means you got yourself a decision to make, Mr. Hero. You can stay out here and keep an eye on that money bag, or you can get your ass back on that train and rescue the passengers. So which will it be? Money or the passengers?
God damn it.
Falcon turned to the train and slipped on board. Falcon guessed that the train robber had retrieved the money bag. In the passenger car, everyone sat riveted, terrified by what was going on. But one man in the back was intensely looking out the window. Falcon walked down the aisle toward him. The man suddenly turned and raised his pistol. Falcon fired. The man fell back across the seat. Falcon ran for the next car.
Stay calm, everybody.
He got off the train!
Thanks.
Falcon started toward the rear exit. Because the car was lit from inside and it was dark outside, the windows acted as mirrors. That fact saved Falcon's life, because glancing at the window nearest the exit, he saw a man aiming a gun at him, and it was the same man who had just told him that the outlaw had left the train. Falcon jerked to one side as the man fired. Falcon shot the man in the throat, sending him crashing through the window by his seat, half in and half out. Seeing that the man was dead, Falcon put his gun back in his holster and looked up at the anxious passengers.
It's all over, folks.
I saw one of them get away with the bag.
You may have seen him right off, but he ain't got away yet.
Mr. McAllister?
The conductor gently shook Falcon away. Falcon opened his eyes and ran his hand across his face.
Yeah?
We're coming into Belfield.
Falcon nodded and looked through the window. It was light now, and he reached into his pocket and pulled out his watch. It was 8:05.
I hated to wake you. You were sleeping so soundly. Lord knows you earned it. But you did say you wanted me to wake you at Belfield.
Oh, yeah. Oh, thanks.
The jerking halts that preceded the train stop was evidence of the fact that the man at the throttle was the fireman, not the engineer. Reaching overhead, Falcon retrieved his saddlebags and rifle, the only luggage he had. He walked to the front of the car and stepped down onto the wooden platform. The depot was a small, red-painted building with a black-on-white sign that read Belfield. No one in Belfield knew of the robbery until the train arrived, but within minutes after arriving in the station, the news spread quickly. Falcon could measure the speed with which the news was traveling according to the change in conversation. He also knew that the arriving passengers were telling of his participation in the excitement, because soon he could feel many sets of eyes staring at him. Looking up toward the baggage car, Falcon saw that the six bodies were being taken down and laid out side by side on the wooden platform.
Don't you dare!
What's that?
Don't you dare lay Cephas's body alongside those other sons of bitches.
That there's Micah Peters. He was a passenger. He don't belong with them outlaws either.
All right. With Cephas and Mr. Peters and that dead gal away from the others.
The curious began to gather around the bodies then. And while Falcon had no particular interest in him, he found himself there as well, because the bodies had been placed very close to the stock car, and Falcon was waiting for his horse to be offloaded.
Hey, I know one of them boys. That one there is Rufus Wade. Me and him cowboyed together last year. That is, till he got drunk and set fire to the bunkhouse. Then Mr. Eddington fired him.
The one identified as Rufus Wade was the one Falcon had shot through the throat.
He's young. He's only 19.
He ain't young. He's dead. Can't get no older than dead. The other two are Buddy Taylor and Curly Latham.
The speaker was a short, stocky, gray-haired man wearing a badge. Even after all these years, Falcon recognized him, and he walked over to the man whose life his mother and father had saved so long ago.
You'd be Billy Puckett?
I am.
Falcon extended his hand.
As near as I can reckon, it's been 32 years since I last saw you. But you haven't changed that much.
You're Falcon McAllister. Welcome to Belfield.
Oh, thank you. When'd you take up sheriffing?
A couple of years ago.
coming up on 20 years now, as soon as I got back from the war.
He said you were 70 years old. It would seem to me like you'd earned the right to sit in a rocking chair for a while.
A fella can't make a living sitting in a rocking chair.
I guess you're right about that.
Another man came up to stand near Falcon and Billy Puckett. This man was also wearing a badge. He was younger, taller, and slimmer than Puckett. He was wearing a big black handlebar mustache.
Falcon, this here's my deputy, Walter Merrill. And Walter's been with me for 5 years now. He's gonna make a good sheriff someday. Fact is, he'd be a good sheriff now if I'd step out of the way.
I ain't ready for you to step out of the way yet, Sheriff. I'm still learning a lot from you.
See why I like this man? He knows how to suck up.
Sheriff Billy Puckett lit a cigar and took several puffs before he spoke again.
Falcon, folks are talking about a big man, passenger on a train who took those outlaws on. I got a strong feeling you were the one they're talking about.
I reckon I am.
I understand they rode off with the money.
Not they, one man.
Goddamn almighty Jesus!
Falcon looked toward the stock car and saw a terrified train employee come scuttering out of it.
Excuse me a second, I've got to see to my horse.
Calm down, Diablo, I'm coming.
Falcon entered the car and led Diablo out.
That's yours? He's a good-looking horse.
Diablo is a good horse. He'll probably live longer than I will.
Yes, well, to be honest with you, Falcon, from all I've heard, I don't know how the hell you stayed alive this long.
Lucky, I guess.
Uh-huh. Listen, Judge Heckmeyer's in town. Just to be on the safe side, why don't you come on down to my office so we can get an official ruling of justifiable homicide on these three? There's no sense in taking a chance on getting some more bad paper out there.
Heckmeyer? Did you say Judge Heckmeyer?
Yes, why? You know him?
No, I don't think I've ever met him, but the name seems familiar to me.
You will come talk to him, though?
All right, but if you don't mind, can I come down after breakfast? I'm a little hungry.
Sure, no hurry. I got to figure out what to do about these three anyway. Damn, Falcon. I invited you up to do a little elk hunting, not cause me all this paperwork.
Oh, sorry about that. Where's a good place for breakfast?
I'd say the Dunn Hotel's about as good as any place.
Falcon ate so many of his meals out on the range that when he did have the chance to eat in town, he ate well. Breakfast this morning consisted of a stack of pancakes, two eggs, fried potatoes, an oversized piece of ham, and half a dozen biscuits. He was just washing it all down with a second cup of coffee when Sheriff Puckett came in.
Join me for a cup of coffee, Billy.
Wish I could, but the judge is over at my office now and he wants to see you.
Well, now's as good a time as any.
Judge Heckmeyer was a relatively large man, bald, with a round face and bulldog jaws. He was sitting at Sheriff Puckett's desk reading a newspaper when Puckett led McAllister in.
Judge, this is Falcon McAllister, the fellow I was telling you about.
Your Honor, I understand that you killed all three of them.
Yeah.
Was it really necessary to kill all three of them?
Yeah.
Not one of them offered to surrender, or made an effort to get away without creating danger to you or any of the passengers?
Not a one.
Judge Heckmeyer drummed his fingers on the desk for a moment as he looked up at Falcon, studying him over the top of his glasses.
Judge, I've already interviewed half a dozen people on the train. They tell me that Falcon wasn't only defending his own life, but he was defending them as well.
Mr. McAllister, there were four train robbers. You killed three. Odd, isn't it, about the one that got away?
What's odd about it?
Well, perhaps odd isn't quite the word I wanted. Perhaps ironic would be better. How exactly did it happen that the one man who did make good his escape did so with the money?
I had to make a choice between retrieving the money or keeping the outlaws who were on the train from shooting any more passengers.
I have heard of you, sir. I've also heard of your prowess with a gun, and I don't like what I hear.
I have always tried, to the best of my ability, to obey the law.
So you say. On the other hand, you always seem to be walking very close to the edge. I know for a fact that there have been wanted dodgers posted for you, and on more than one occasion.
And they have been withdrawn every time.
Yes, they have been withdrawn. But the question remains, how is it that so many of them have been issued in the first place?
Now, I can't explain that.
Well, perhaps I can. This is what I think, Mr. McAllister. I think that you are a murder case waiting to happen. You are like a moth flying close to the flame. So far, you have avoided the flame. You have managed to stay on the right side of the law. Although, and I think that even you will agree with me, you have barely managed to do so.
Yes, sir.
Mr. McAllister, it has been my experience that wanted posters are not frivolously issued. In every case, a law enforcement authority somewhere has been convinced that you were guilty of one felony or another. Then, no sooner are the circulars issued than something turns up that temporarily exonerates you. But your luck cannot continue, Mr. McAllister. Where there is smoke, there is fire, and I feel certain that one day that fire is going to flare up and, like the moth, you will be consumed by it.
Your ruling, Judge?
Yes, my ruling. I'm going to rule that these three men died by the hand of Falcon McAllister.
Judge Heckmeyer held up a finger.
By the hand of Falcon McAllister in an act of justifiable homicide. I have no choice. The facts compel me to do this. But I shall be keeping an eye on you, Mr. McAllister. Yes, sir, I will be keeping an eye on you.
It had rained earlier in the day, and when Thad Howard rode into the little town of Sheffield, the street was a quagmire. The mud, worked into the consistency of quicksand by the horse's hooves, had mixed with the droppings to become one long, stinking, sucking pool of ooze. When the rain stopped, the sun, yellow and hot in its late afternoon transit, had begun the process of evaporation. The result was a foul miasma rising from the offal of the street. The saloon wasn't hard to find. It was the biggest and grandest building in the entire town. Because of the shadows, there was an illusion of coolness inside the saloon. But it was an illusion only. The dozen and a half customers who were drinking had to keep their bandanas handy to wipe the sweat from their faces. Thad looked over everyone in the room. No one was wearing a badge, and none of the drinkers seemed to pose a problem. From all he could tell, there were only cowboys and drifters here, and less than half of them were even wearing guns. A couple of the cowboys were wearing their guns low and kicked out gunfighter style, but Thad could tell at a glance that it was all for show. He was certain they had never used their guns for anything but target practice, and probably were not very successful at that. The bartender stood at the end of the bar, wiping the used glasses with his stained apron, then setting them among the unused glasses. When he saw Thad step up to the bar, he moved down toward him.
What'll it be?
I'm supposed to meet my brothers in here.
Your name Thad?
Yeah.
They're here. You owe me $6.
$6? What the hell for?
That's how much tab they already run up.
Get me a beer.
I ain't getting nothing till you pay up to $6. You got it or not?
Although Thad had buried most of the money just outside of town, he had brought over $100 with him. He counted out $6 and gave it to the bartender.
Here! I'll have that beer now.
Come right up.
Now, where the hell are my brothers?
Upstairs in their room.
You rent rooms here?
I do.
Sleeping or sporting?
Either way you want.
What room are my brothers in?
Number 23, just atop the stairs.
Thad climbed up the stairs.
What? Hey, what the hell?
In the bed, Thad saw two men and a woman. The woman scrambled to cover her nakedness.
I got it!
Hey!
Yeah!
What's going on here?
This here's our brother.
If you expect me to take him on too, it's gonna cost you more.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you want to join in?
Yeah. Hell with that. We got enough for each of us to have our own whore.
Billy Puckett showed Falcon around town, introducing him to the mayor, the banker, the newspaper publisher, and the saloon owner. He walked him to the hotel and made certain that he got the best room in the house. Then that night, he invited Falcon to have dinner with him. The Dunn Hotel proudly advertised bathing rooms on every floor, and Falcon took a bath and changed clothes. When he stepped into the hotel dining room, he felt like a new man.
Good evening. You would be Mr. McAllister?
The maitre d' somewhat surprised Falcon because he hadn't been there for breakfast.
Yeah, I'm McAllister.
Sheriff Puckett is waiting for you.
Falcon followed the maitre d' through the crowded dining room to a table in the far back corner. There were no windows near the table, and because the table was in the corner, both Falcon and the sheriff would be able to sit with their backs to the wall. Sheriff Puckett stood as Falcon approached, reached out again to shake his hand, and then the two men sat. A waiter materialized to take their order.
Would you like some wine, sir?
I prefer some sipping whiskey.
I'll have the same.
Very good, gentlemen.
Don't run off yet. Let's see here. I'll have the beefsteak and fried potatoes.
Same for me.
Not until the waiter returned to the kitchen with their order did Puckett resume the conversation.
Falcon, I want to apologize for the way the judge behaved this morning. Actually, he is a fine and principled man.
Oh, I don't have any trouble with his principles. It's the fact that he prejudged me that I don't like.
I can see how you'd be a mite upset over that. But like I say, he is an honest man. I have to tell you, Falcon, I'm very happy you accepted my invitation. And a little surprised as well.
Well, I'd hold up long enough. I figured it was about time for me to get out again. And I confess that I've thought about you from time to time, wondering whatever happened to that fella Paul brought in more dead than alive.
Your Pa was a good man, and your Ma was a saint, nursing me the way she did.
You know, I don't think I've ever asked you, but how did you happen to wind up in Indian Territory in the first place?
I had a bad winter once. Went to the rendezvous with some of the sorriest beaver skins you ever seen. I heard a bunch of folks talking about a stream where the beaver were as thick as flies. Only thing is, it was Indian territory and everyone was afraid to go there.
Let me guess. You figured if everyone else was afraid to go there, it would just make the pickings that much better for you.
Boy, you read my mind. And it was a good plan, too. I was halfway through the season, had more pelts than I'd taken in the previous 2 years, and they were good pelts, too. Then one day, when I was running my traps, a party of Indians showed up. I tried to parley with them, but they weren't in a talking mood. Next thing you know, they was ordering me out, without my beaver skins. Well, I wasn't going to have that, so I pointed my rifle at them and ordered them to get.
I take it they didn't get.
They rode out about 50 yards from me, then turned back. By then, they had arrows in their bows, and they meant business. I shot one of them, but I took a couple of arrows before I could reload. Don't know why they didn't take my scalp, but when I come to, your Pa was over me. Don't know what he was doing there or how he found me.
Pa had a lot of friends among the Indians. He never told me flat out, but I would guess they told him about you.
Well, I'm glad for that. Like I said, I wouldn't be here now if your Pa hadn't found me and your Ma hadn't nursed me through.
Now, Billy, there was something else in your letter that got my attention. You said you had something you needed to get off your chest.
Yeah. It's something that's been bothering me for years now. I need to talk to someone about it. Well, since it involves you, I picked you.
It involves me? Are you talking about something that happened 34 years ago?
No, this was more like 20 years ago.
20 years ago and it involves me? How can it? I didn't run into you 20 years ago.
You were in the war?
Yeah.
You were at Chattanooga?
Yeah.
So was I.
You were? I don't remember seeing you there.
I saw you.
Why didn't you say something to me?
I was wearing blue. You were wearing gray.
Billy, that's not what you're trying to get off your chest, is it? I mean, the fact that you wore blue and I wore gray. You may not know this, but some of my brothers fought for the Union.
It's more than that. I want to tell you a story.
All right. I'm listening.
The sheriff began telling the story. Falcon found himself slipping back in time, reliving those days when, as a young man, barely in his 20s, he fought for the Confederacy, riding as a scout for Morgan's Raiders. The shock waves of the bridge explosion moved across the field and hit Falcon, making his stomach shake. Finally, the whole bridge collapsed into the river.
Now, that's the way to do it. We dropped her into the water just as neat as a pin.
I suppose so.
What's wrong, Captain? You don't sound very enthused about it. It was a good job, and it'll delay the Yankees for at least a week.
Don't forget, McAllister, I live here.
I watched them build that trestle before the war. You know how long it took?
No, sir, I don't.
It took 7 weeks. We blow it up in 7 seconds, and the most we can hope to get out of it is to delay the Yankees by 6 or 7 days. And it was our bridge in the first place. The tracks, the bridges, the roads, everything we're destroying down here belongs to the South. What kind of a war is it when we strike at the enemy by destroying the property of our own people?
It's a terrible war, Captain. That's the kind we've got. On the other hand, look at it this way. Better to give them one bridge than a whole town.
I guess you're right.
Sergeant Haberkopf, who had been on lookout, came riding up.
Captain, begging your pardon, sir, but there's a Yankee cavalry coming.
Very good, Sergeant. Get the men mounted.
Whoa. Captain, we aren't turning tail, are we? Shouldn't we stay and fight them?
How are your shoes holding out, Lieutenant?
My shoes?
Aren't the soles getting a little thin?
Well, now you mention it, I reckon they are.
If the Yankee cavalry is here, that means their supply depot isn't guarded. I say we do a little shopping, then burn what we can't carry away with us. It's about time we destroyed some Yankee property.
Captain Ward led his men into the supply depot, thinking it would be almost totally unguarded. But to his surprise, there was an infantry company waiting. Ward fell with the first volley. Falcon leaped from his horse to try to rescue his captain, but bullets were whizzing all around him.
Go! Get out of here! Take the men and go!
One mini-ball took off Falcon's hat, and another penetrated the loose flap of his sleeve.
Lieutenant! Let's not lose both of us here! I order you to get the men out now!
Yes, sir.
Falcon remounted.
Fall back! Fall back!
Confederates withdrew, riding hard until they were well out of range. Then Falcon stopped.
What do we do now, Lieutenant?
I know we left Captain Ward and at least two of our men alive back there. We wait until nightfall, Haberkopf. Then we go back and get him.
Dismounting, he counted off every fourth man, designating him to be a horse holder. Then, advancing on foot, Falcon led the rest down to the clearing where the ambush had taken place earlier in the day. What they saw stopped them in their tracks.
I hung him.
I beg your pardon?
It was me that hung him, Falcon. Captain Ward, Private Higgins, and Private Morrison. I was in command of the Union infantry troops that were guarding the depot.
Falcon was quiet for a long moment. The rage he had felt at the time he discovered the bodies of his captain and two of his men hanging from a tree limb had long since subsided.
Why?
Rebels had destroyed 3 bridges, knocked down more than 100 telegraph poles, and robbed 2 supply wagons. I had orders to make an example of anyone we caught who was engaged in that activity.
So you killed your prisoners?
Puckett stared at the untouched steak on his plate.
Yes. God help me, I killed them. At the time, I thought it was a legitimate act of war. But I know now, and have known for many years, and what I did was wrong. It has haunted me ever since.
Why are you telling me this now, after all these years?
I was there when you attacked the depot. I saw you jump down from your horse and try to save Ward. At first, I thought you were your father. You looked so much like him. But then I saw that you were too young to be Jamie. I asked Ward, and he confirmed who you were.
Captain Ward had a wife, 2 kids.
I didn't know that.
He didn't tell you?
Other than confirming who you were, he never said a word. He didn't even say anything when we put the noose around his neck.
Would it made any difference if you'd known?
At the time, I don't think it would have. Now, it just adds to my burden. I reckon what I'm doing is asking for your forgiveness.
I can't do that. It's not that I won't, it's that I can't. I don't think I have that right. If it's forgiveness you're wanting, I reckon you're gonna have to get that from the families of the men you hanged.
I can't do that. I can't ask them for forgiveness until I can forgive myself.
Falcon saw the pain in Sheriff Puckett's face.
Billy, I expect that if truth were known,
There's no one who fought in that war that doesn't have something they'd just as soon forget. I know that I have my own ghost chasing me. It's something that we all have to live with. You didn't do what you did out of malice of heart, but because you deemed it your duty. But if it's any consolation to you, I want you to know that I'm not holding what you did against you. That was then, and this is now.
Looking Puckett in the eye, Falcon offered his hand in friendship.
As far as I'm concerned, you're still the same brave, strong man who told me stories as a boy of your adventures in the mountains.
A look of relief came across Billy's face then, and he took Falcon's hand in his own.
Thanks, Falcon. You've just taken a huge load off my heart.
The Howard brothers had been in Sheffield in the Dakota Territory for almost 2 weeks, and during that time they had spent money like water. All three sported new clothes. Thad had a new hat. Creed was wearing new boots. They bought drinks for everyone in the saloon several times and lost money in poker games without complaint. If there was any complaint, it was that whores of the town, anxious to get their share of that money, paid so much attention to the three Howard brothers that the others felt left out. They established a habit of eating their breakfast in bed every morning, although because they were staying up late each night, morning for them came in around 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. When Thad came down the steps from his room, the bartender smiled and called out to him.
Mr. Howard, it come in this morning.
What come in this morning?
Why, your champagne, of course. Don't you remember the other day when you asked me to order it? Well, I did, and it come up from McAllister.
Hot damn! Give me the bottle.
Thad's brothers came down a few minutes later.
Boys, we gonna drink us some champagne.
What for?
Because of the way folks talk about it all the time. I want to see what it is they're carrying on about.
By now, several others in the saloon, none of whom had ever tasted champagne, had gathered around the three brothers and their hanger-on whores to watch the proceedings. Thad bit down on the cork to pull it off.
Lord, no! Don't do it that way.
Why not?
You try and take it off that way, you'd not knock out your teeth. Here, let me do it.
The hell you say? This is my bar. I done bought and paid for it. Just tell me how to open it.
The bartender demonstrated how to do it by putting his thumbs under the cork and pushing up. Thad began following the bartender's directions, and slowly the cork began easing its way up the neck of the bottle.
Damn, what's wrong with it? It don't seem to want to...
The cork flew 3/4 of the way across the room. Champagne spewed from the bottle. Thad stuck the bottle in his mouth and tried to drink, but wound up coughing and choking instead. Finally, when the fizz had died down a little, Thad and his brothers Creed and Bob started passing the bottle back and forth.
Hey, come on, y'all. Don't be greedy. Share that thing.
Hell no! You think I'm gonna let a whore have some of this?
When the last of the champagne was gone, Thad wiped his lips with the sleeve of his shirt, then looked at his two brothers.
I hope you enjoyed it, boys, because it's all gone.
Well, it wasn't all that good anyway, if you ask me. I'd as soon drink horse piss. Let's just get us another bottle of whiskey.
We can't.
What do you mean?
Ain't just the champagne that's all gone. It's the money, too. We spent every dime we got.
You ain't got no more money?
Thad turned his pockets inside out by way of demonstration.
Well, shit! You won't be needing us anymore. Come on, girls.
Oh, wait a minute. You mean after all the money we done spent on you, you ain't gonna stay with us anymore? I thought we might go back up to the rooms for a little more fun.
No money, no fun.
No money, no room either. I reckon you boys better be moving on.
The hell you say. After all the money we spent here, you owe us. Now give us a bottle of whiskey.
The bartender reached under the bar, but when he brought his hands up again, they were wrapped around a double-barrel greener.
I expect you boys had better get on out of town.
Why, you low-ass bastard.
Thad reached for his pistol.
You want to try it, mister?
Come on, Thad. Let's go.
Thad glared at the bartender for a while longer. Then, with a shrug, he turned and started toward the door with his two brothers following him.
Bye, boys. Come back when you have money again. Lots of money.
Outside the livery, the three brothers saddled and mounted their horses. When they started to ride away, though, Thad went one way while Bob and Creed went another.
Hey, Thad, ain't you coming with us?
Nah, I ain't going with you.
Well, what are you gonna do?
Thad shrugged.
Well, what are we gonna do? We don't have no money.
Thad didn't even give him the benefit of an answer.
Well, I'll be dipping dog shit.